We're going to continue with biblical prophecy and postmillennialism. Again, historical expectations according to the Bible. This is part 8. And this is part 3 of Daniel, the prophetical. Continuing with the prophetical. I want to point out from the directory for the public worship of God, of public prayer before the sermon, we're told to pray for the propagation of the gospel and kingdom of Christ to all nations, for the conversion of the Jews, the fullness of the Gentiles, the fall of Antichrist, and the hastening of the second coming of our Lord, for the deliverance of the distressed churches abroad from the tyranny of the anti-Christian faction and from the cruel oppressions and blasphemies of the Turk. In that prayer, in that part of the public prayer, we can see once more that the nature of the view of prophecy taken by the assembly was historical. They were historicists. They did not see the fall of Antichrist as something in the past, but something future to them. They also express here a concern about the Turk or Islam. And so we want to look at these prophecies and we want to think about what is involved. We're going to talk about Daniel 8. We'll look at a number of passages throughout Daniel 8. We'll see a refinement in Daniel's understanding that he receives. Remember, Daniel 8, Daniel's prophecy moves from Aramaic back into Hebrew. And so it's a veiled prophecy in some respect. So I want to point out, again, just the general outline of the argument. I don't want to get into all the specifics. I'm really not trying to answer every specific along the way. But I think there are outlines and there are contours to this argument. That once you gain an understanding of the contours, you're going to have a better understanding of what the Bible is, in fact, teaching. So we're going to begin looking at Daniel 8, verse 1.
Daniel 8, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first.
We're told that Daniel, this vision is appearing during the reign of King Belshazzar. So we've clearly now moved from the Babylonian to the Medo-Persian. And this vision takes its rise from that period of time. Daniel's not going back. He's not looking at the past. He's concerned with constructing a vision of the future. He's concerned with mapping out the course that Israel is going to take. And ultimately, as we see, a course that has bearing on the Church of God. So, in Daniel 8:2, we need to look at that.
Daniel 8, verse 2. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass, when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river of Ulai.
Yeah, Daniel is describing here then the phenomenon of visions. Remember, before this he's been having dreams. And now this is a vision, which is sort of like a daydream. He's sitting there and he sees something that's passing before his eyes. And one of the things he notices in this is he sees himself by the river Ulai. And that river is like some of the other rivers that we find the prophets, if you remember Ezekiel, Ezekiel prophesies by the river Kibar. here's Daniel prophesying. We're having a vision by the river Ulai. There's been speculation as to what this river is, where it is. It's clearly in Persia. Also, almost certainly it is a river that is that has to do with branching off of the Gihon River. If you remember, there were four rivers running out of paradise. This, they believe now, was a canal that was built. And it was built off of one of these original rivers coming out of paradise. But it's clearly in Persia. There's been some speculation as to why these prophets keep prophesying by rivers, and it's in all likelihood has something to do with the fact that they were accustomed to build their synagogues near rivers, the Jews, because, or meet near rivers. If you remember, Lydia was in the book of Acts, they're already meeting down by the river. They did ritual purifications. Running water was a good thing for them. They wanted it. So meeting by a river, having this vision and standing by a river is not, in fact, out of keeping with this idea. It's a very Jewish milieu that's going on with his vision. There are things that are peculiar to the way Jews did things. All right, we want to look at Daniel 8:3.
Daniel 8, verse 3. I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last.
Yeah, what Daniel sees here is very interesting. He's standing by this river, and the river is some kind of boundary for Persia, in all likelihood, as we'll see in a moment, because there appears before him at this river a ram, and it has two horns. The two horns, we're told, are high. They're big horns. This is a ram with very big horns, but then we're told the one horn was higher than the other, and that the higher horn came last. Now, these two horns are talking about, and the ram represents the kingdom, that second kingdom of Medo-Persia. So, the Medes are the first part of that component. They're the first horn. But the second horn, even though they're both high, the second horn, Persia, the Persian Empire, is actually going to be higher. It's going to be more defined, more definite, more aggressive power than the Medes. So, we know that Shushan is, in fact, where he's having this vision, Shushan is the capital of Persia. He's having this vision in Persia. And this vision is a vision that has to do with the Persian Empire, really the Medo-Persian Empire, and as we'll see, what brings about its demise. Now, why is it in Hebrew? It's very likely, in fact, that had this been in Aramaic, had this been in the language of the court, if it had been discovered, any invasion would have invited the Medes and the Persians to look at the Jews as a potential fifth column to be eliminated. So by speaking in roundabout terms here as they begin to get very specific about what's going to happen to the Medo-Persian Empire. They're that second kingdom. We see that it returns to Hebrew in order to avoid that kind of clash. This is information meant for the people of God and not necessarily information to be given to all the nations. Remember, in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, God wanted him to know that he had raised him up and had cast him down and raised him up again. And all of that appears in a language that would have been much more accessible to him. So if we look now at verse 20,
Daniel 8, verse 20, the ram which thou sawest have two horns are kings of Media and Persia.
Yeah, Daniel 8:20 confirms that this is the correct identification of these two horns. It's Media and Persia. It's the Medo-Persian Empire. So he's told that. He's told what to expect, and he's told why, as we'll see. Daniel knows then that he's in the palace in Shushan. He's in the capital city. Here he is at the center of that second empire. He's made it from Babylon to Medo-Persia. He's remained at the center of all of that. Now he sees the beginning of the breakdown of the Medo-Persian Empire. But what are we told that this ram does? Well, let's look first at Daniel 8:4.
Daniel 8, verse 4. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beasts might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great.
Yeah, he does what? He's pushing westward, northward, and southward. So if we imagine Persia is in the Far East, movements of the Persian Empire as they're coming, what are they doing? They're moving that empire, they're moving to the south. That is, they're going into Egypt. They're moving west into the region of Palestine, Israel. They're moving north, even up into the kingdom of the Macedonian kingdom, the Greeks. And that's going to have very serious ramifications for them, as we will see in a moment. So this Persian Empire is expansive. Now, they take the Babylonian Empire and they're expanding north, south, and west. Now, if we look back at Daniel 7:5.
Daniel 7, verse 5, and behold, another beast, second unto a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh.
We're told that the second beast in Daniel's dreams and visions, the dream that he had, or the vision, the night vision, about the four great beasts diverse, that second beast, the bear, which corresponds here with the ram, has been given a command to devour much flesh, or to expand and take in a lot more territory and a lot more people. So that's what the ram is doing. It's expanding. It's expanding west, north, south. And while it's in this phase, we're told that no beast might stand before him. In other words, there's no imperial power. There's no kingdom. Babylon doesn't stand before the Medes and Persians when they invade and conquer. And as the Medes and Persians look west, as they look north, as they look south, there's no one to stop them. They're fulfilling that command that was given, arise and devour much flesh. It's a violent kingdom. It's a kingdom that, like all of these kingdoms, is really grinding the masses under their feet. Remember, these kingdoms of men existed for those at the top, to serve them. And they really had no qualms about using people. We would describe it as cannon fodder. They would send them out, and it didn't really matter how many people they would kill, either on their side or the other side, so long as they prevailed. They were interested in prevailing. Here we see that providentially all lets or all hindrances are taken out of the way. They move forward. There's nothing really that can stop them. The Medo-Persian Empire, then, is an empire that expands from that region of Babylon or Nineveh, the old Assyrian Empire, and it actually goes into Asia Minor, certain parts of Europe, and down even into Africa. Right, we want to look next at Daniel 8:5.
And as I was considering, behold, an he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes.
Yeah, as he's considering Medo-Persia, he's met with something else. There's a he-goat coming from the west. And it's not touching the ground. The fact that he's coming from the west, and we're told that it's on the face of the whole earth, we can see this he-goat is, in fact, pushing back. If the Persians are coming from the east-west, now all of a sudden, as Daniel's contemplating, he sees another power moving toward that ram, a he-goat, at breakneck speed. Not touching the ground. It's fast. And it has a notable horn between his eyes, which we'll talk about in just a moment. If we remember, when we talk about the speed of all of this, if we think back, or even look back at Daniel 7, Daniel 7, verse 6, I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. And the beast also had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. We'll talk about the four heads in a moment. But what we see are four wings given to this leopard. Now, a leopard is already a very, very fast animal, fast-moving predator. With four wings, it's fast and it's not even going to touch the ground. This is the third kingdom, then, coming. So we're told the third kingdom that Daniel sees, and this is the third kingdom in Nebuchadnezzar's vision. We're told it's coming from the west, and it's coming, rapidly coming, toward Medo-Persia. Of course, this is a problem for Medo-Persia. They've been expanding westward, northward, and southward, and they've met with no opposition. And as Daniel is contemplating that, as he's considering all of that, as he's considering that there was none that could deliver out of their hand, quite unexpectedly, this he-goat appears. So what do we see? Well, I think what we see, one thing we see is that like so many of these kingdoms that flourish upon the earth, these great empires. They flourish for a time, and it seems like they're unstoppable, that their power is unbreakable. And yet, if we could see the end from the beginning, and Daniel gets a little glimpse of that, we can see that that's not the case. Now, we already knew this, right? We knew this from Nebuchadnezzar's vision. We also knew it from Daniel's night vision. And Medo-Persia is going to expand as long as that voice commands, arise, go, devour much flesh. But at such time as in the providence of God, it's time to put an end or a bound to that, then bounded it is. And that's what's happening. There's a bounding in of this he-goat. Now, we want to look at Daniel 8:21 because we get a little bit of an idea of who we're talking about.
Daniel 8, verse 21. And the rough goat is the king of Persia, and the horn is, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king.
Yeah, what is the he-goat? What's that representing? The king of Greece, the Greek Empire. And that, as we will see here in a moment, that's Alexander the Great. But the horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Who is the first king of the Macedonian or Greek Empire? Philip of Macedon. Alexander's father. He's the one that began this process of consolidating. He is the one that, in fact, has put Alexander on his course. It was Philip of Macedon, after all, who retained Aristotle to tutor young Alexander. And the Greeks, as we're going to see in a moment, they have a problem with the Persians. They're not happy. You know, as an ascending power, they don't like this idea of being subjugated, a subjugated people. And yet that's what Medo-Persia did. And so, empire number two, in essence, as we're going to see, is going to provoke empire number three. They're going to move them into action. So that, just as I said before, very often we can't see the end from the beginning. We can't see how anyone would have ever arisen to have stopped Babylon. And then there's Medo-Persia. We can't see how anybody could have stopped Medo-Persia. And then there's this guy, Philip of Macedon, who consolidates enough power and has enough foresight to retain the most brilliant philosopher of his day to school his son. And Alexander, by all accounts, was a very, very astute student. Paid attention to his teacher. He learned a lot. He was very well educated. And it was, for the time, would have been considered a very well-rounded education. So it's not that he was simply educated in one area. Alexander had probably for that time one of the broadest ranges of knowledge. And a lot of that he owed to his father. His father knew that this would be important. So we want to continue now looking at Daniel 8, verses 6 and 7.
Daniel 8, verses 6 and 7. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand.
There's none to deliver out of his hand. So, Belshazzar is the end of the Chalcedonian Empire, the Babylonian Empire. Daniel's having this vision at the very end. It's the cusp. He's at the palace in Shushan, which is going to be the center of Medo-Persia. He's seeing this just as that's breaking. But no sooner is Medo-Persia breaking out on the world scene, Daniel already knows what the end of it is. He knows who's going to do it. He knows they're going to come to an end. It's going to be brought about by the Greeks. In fact, he knows it's going to be the king of Greece. It's going to be heading this endeavor. Remember, horns signify power. Horns are signs of power and dominance. So, the he-goat comes out. He comes to the ram with the two horns, which Daniel saw standing before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And that's very much in keeping with what Alexander does. As things move from Belshazzar to Darius to Cyrus the Persian, the first big military victory against the empire, first big dent, was Alexander defeating Darius, and the river that they're standing by is known as the Granicus. It was around the year 334 BC. They actually had a clash there. Greeks came in, and although Darius had overwhelming forces, yet every military advantage at that time, everything that would have been considered a military advantage, the fact is this: it did him no good. Alexander took his much smaller army and ran it into the army of Darius with such force that Darius's army dissolved before him. He plowed through them. Now we're told that I saw him come close under the ram. He was moved with choler against him. That is, the Greeks were mad, as I said. They were mad. They were upset with the treatment they had received at the hands of the Persians in their westward move. They were very upset. They didn't like them. They didn't like being subdued by them. Now, the Greeks thought of themselves as being the center of civilization and high culture. Who are these Persians coming in? And they may have fine rugs and magi, but we have philosophy. We have a system of government. We know stuff about architecture. We understand things that those Persians may not really understand. They viewed themselves as very different people. And so they were very unhappy. But the prospect of rising up against an empire the size of the Persian Empire must have seemed daunting. Nonetheless, Alexander does it. And he runs at it with all his might. And we're told that he smote the ram and brake his two horns. In other words, Alexander hit it so hard that he knocked out the Medes and the Persians. The alliance that they had that they brought together in order to defeat Babylon, even though it gave them this numeric advantage and many things that should have been conducive to a military advantage, Alexander was not moved by that. And by the way, Alexander, this battle, he's not doing this near Greece. He's taking him on. He's run from the west to the east. He's going toward Persia. And the armies need supply lines. But Alexander moves so fast that he needed a lot less in the way of supply. And they must not have had a whole lot of warning that he was coming. And if you are sitting at the top of the empire chain, or the food chain known as the four, what will become known as the four great empires, you're probably not thinking that a guy with an army that size is going to take you down. But they hit the Medo-Persians with such abandon that it shocked them and dissolved them. The Persian Empire crumbles before Daniel. We're told there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. That's right, there was none. They had no recourse. There was nowhere for them to turn. We want to look next at Daniel 8:8.
Daniel 8:8. Therefore, the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven.
Yeah, the he-goat waxed very, very great. When he was strong, the great horn was broken. And for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So we're told that this Greek Empire, in fact, becomes very great. That's first of all. We're also told that in the height of its strength, the great horn is broken. We're talking now about the death of Alexander the Great. Power. Philip of Macedon's power was in Alexander. Those who succeeded Alexander, his son and his wife, and all those who stood in the line of succession were actually killed very soon after he died. This, again, goes back to Daniel 7:6. The beast, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl, the beast had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. So it has four heads. Here we're told that there are four notable ones. It's broken, and four notable ones come up toward the four winds of heaven. So the third kingdom, when it dissolves into four. Just like if you remember that fourth kingdom, when we talked about dissolving into ten. Here we're told that the third kingdom actually dissolves into four. And we're going to talk about that in just a minute. These are notable ones. As Daniel 8:8 says, they are called four heads in Daniel 7:6. So although there's a lot of power, the Greek Empire is powerful, it moves forward rapidly, its time in the sun is actually quite brief. Alexander dies in his 30s. The entire time of his conquest, just a matter of a few years. And yet, it was devastating. What he did was devastating. What he did was brilliant, and it was devastating to the Persians. It destroyed their empire. The Persians, the Medo-Persians at least, had had, from what we can tell, a little bit of a succession. The Greeks, when Alexander dies, everything falls apart. So we end up with four notable ones. We want to look at Daniel 8:22.
Daniel 8:22. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power.
Yeah, there are four. We're told that the four stand for four kingdoms. Four notable ones are four kingdoms. And we're also told this, that none of them are going to stand in the power of Alexander, right? None of them will exercise that kind of dominion. That remains for a fourth kingdom or a fourth power. So Daniel's four notable ones are four kings or four kingdoms. Historically, here's what we know about them. We actually know the names and the dominions of the four kings. And, like Daniel says, we can even assign them toward the four winds of the earth. So, to the north, we have the kingdom of Lysimachus. And he takes over Thrace, which is part of modern-day Bulgaria and part of Turkey, and that whole region that we know as Asia Minor, and even some of Macedonia. To the west, there is the kingdom of Cassander, and that kingdom is taken up with Macedonia and Greece, what's left of what Alexander had that was centered in the kingdom of his father, Cassander. To the south, we have Ptolemy. And he gets Egypt and Palestine, Cilicia, Petra, which is a region in near Palestine, and even the island of Cyprus. To the east, we have Seleucus, the Seleucid Empire. And they get... He gets Syria, Babylon, Persia, and India. These four kings are really four of his generals. These are the men who had accompanied Alexander into battle. And when he dies, these are the men who divide up the kingdom when Alexander's offspring, when Alexander's successors demonstrate that they just don't have what it takes to run an empire. But neither do any of these guys. Right? These guys are all over the place. They're really not able to take on and control everything. Alexander had somehow managed to maintain control. When he ruled, Greek ruled. The Greek Empire ruled. Even though it was a short period of time, the influence of the Greeks would become an extremely important part or component of the fabric of the ancient world. The Greeks, when they take over, wherever they take over, one of the first things they do is they introduce the Greek language. And with that comes philosophy, which brings with it science and math. They've assimilated a lot of the mathematics of the Persian Empire. The Greeks are, in fact, bringing high culture and building on ancient cultures, which were already, in some respects, relatively advanced. But they're bringing that. But when Alexander dies, nobody can run this whole thing. No one can administer it all. And so the four great generals end up taking control of the sections of the empire that had been, to a greater or lesser degree, left under their control. Alexander, after all, preferred to be out on the battlefield conquering more people. He'd leave behind military generals in regions. So when he dies and word gets back, they divide it all up. And they divide it up pretty well along those lines, north, south, east, and west. At least if you're standing where Daniel is and your mind is in Jerusalem. North, south, east, and west work from Jerusalem pretty well. Remember again, he's writing this in Hebrew. This is for the people of God in the Holy Land. All right, we want to look next about next at Daniel 8, 9.
Daniel 8, verse 9. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land.
Right, toward the south, and toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. Out of one of them, out of which? Well, I think we have to rule out... We really have to rule out Ptolemy and the Seleucid Empire because, in fact, he's waxing great toward them. He's also looking toward the east, or toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land, which is Judea. And so, out of this four... arises another development. And this development's very important, I think, when we consider the prophetic prospects of Scripture. This little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes. And he, as we'll see, is in fact a type of the Antichrist that is going to arise in the East. What he does, as we'll see in a moment, is something that is reserved for the Islamic powers to do. This is not the same little horn that we saw in Daniel 7. This is a different little horn. The little horn that arose out of the 10 arose out of the dissolution of the Roman Empire and at a later time. This little horn is coming out of the Greek Empire, and it has certain characteristics that are going to come up several times yet in the book of Daniel, and we're going to have to talk about them. Now, there are also, I think, some problems with seeing this as being fulfilled in anything other than a typical way in Antiochus Epiphanes. Not least is the direction that he's moving and what he's doing. When we compare this, and we talk about the abomination of desolation that Christ refers to on the Olivet Discourse, he's referring back to something Antiochus Epiphanes does. But Antiochus Epiphanes is, in fact, a type of Antichrist. He's an anti-messianic figure. But he's separate from that other little horn, who is also an anti-messianic figure. We want to look at Daniel 8, verses 10 through 12, to gain a little bit better idea of what it is we're talking about here.
Daniel 8, verses 10 and 12. Now wax great, even to the host of heaven, and cast down some of the hosts and of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. And an host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered.
Yeah, this idea of this horn casting down some of the host of heaven and of the stars to the ground and stamping upon them, this language is going to come up again in the book of Revelation. This idea. And so it is a proud figure. It's a figure that has magnified himself even to the prince of the host. By him the daily sacrifice is taken away. He's set against the temple worship. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression. It cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and it prospered. So in its casting down of the truth to the ground, we're told it practiced and it prospered. So it's a proud horn. It is a horn, and remember, a horn is a power, which waxed exceeding great. Its greatness, in fact, is toward the south and toward the east. That is, and this is where I think we have to begin to see some problems with a full identification here of Antiochus. Just like we can't see Isaiah 7:14, the young woman who bears a child, it can't be Isaiah's wife. She may be a type of what is in view, and the child born in Isaiah 8 may be a type of what is in view, but we know from the Gospels that Christ is the one that was intended. So likewise, there are things here. He's turning toward the south and toward the east. And this is more in keeping with Islam. Egypt is Islamic now. Persia is Islamic now. Iraq or Syria and Syria. All those areas that we're looking, the south and the east, if you look at those areas, Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Babylon, Persia, India, Islam has overrun vast portions of that. Islam, you may think of India as being Hindu, but the fact is that they spun off to their west. They spun off a country that we call Pakistan. And they did so because that was overwhelmingly Islamic. But they still have a lot of Muslims within India. So these are areas which have been overrun by Islam. And they come ultimately out of this Greek, the dissolution of the Greek kingdom. And we're going to return to this a couple of times in the book of Daniel. So although I'm not denying that Antiochus Epiphanes is an antitype here, and that he, in many respects, demonstrates some fulfillment, he certainly does not demonstrate all of the characteristics that we see, including, this idea that he practiced and prospered and cast down the truth to the ground. For a very brief period of time, Antiochus does that. But in what he does and how he does it, you see, that's where he, in fact, resembles Islam and what we would call the Eastern Antichrist, and what we pray against when we pray for the fall of Islam and the Turkish or the Islamic Antichrist. There is a resurgent paganism in Islam. We want to look at Daniel 8:23-25.
Daniel 8, verses 23 to 25. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, the king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power, and he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand.
You know, here again, if we look at what we're told, that at the latter time of their kingdom, that is, these four that stand up, but not in the power of Alexander, as they're sort of fizzling out. The Roman Empire doesn't really get the kind of grasp over some of this eastern part of the empire. They're not extending out to Persia. So when we see them rising up, they're not taking over. They're going west. They're not going east so much. Yes, they get into Palestine, but they don't get all the way out to Babylon, really. They're not controlling that. They're not really getting down into Egypt so much either. They don't have that kind of reach. But here we're told that a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And there have been some who suggested understanding dark sentences has to do with the Quran. The fact is that when we compare some of the language here, when we get to Revelation, I think we'll see that, again, if this is Antiochus, it's Antiochus as an antitype of the great Islamic Antichrist that is in view here. He's coming into play at the latter time of, that is, the Greek Empire, as it is, in fact, what's left of it when it divides in these four kingdoms, as this is coming to an end. By his power shall he be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully and shall prosper in practice. He shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. He's going to be set against the true religion. We know this. Now, the Greeks were not, nor was Antiochus Epiphanes, although he does, in fact, go into Palestine, and for a time, he suspends the daily sacrifice on the altar. And he offers up swine. He's a profane man, and he's a God-hater, no doubt. But here there's even more said about this, because we're told that through his policy, he's going to cause craft to prosper in his hand, and by peace he shall destroy many. Remember, Islam is described as the religion of peace. The word Islam means peace. And he shall stand up against the prince of princes. You see that the King James has capitalized that there. That's a messianic reference. And part of the problem here with identifying this as Antiochus is, in fact, Antiochus lives and dies. He dies around 165 B.C. He's dying 165 years before, 160 years before Christ. So he's not really offering opposition to the prince of princes per se, whereas Islam has and does and continues. Islam, in fact, fulfills the very things that are being typified here. Now, how long shall the period described last? Well, in order to understand that, we need to look at Daniel 8, 13, 14, and 26.
Daniel 8, 13 and 14. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden under foot? And he said unto me, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Verse 26. And the vision of the evening and the morning, which was told, is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days.
Okay, so here, really, if we think about this, we need to understand, and there have been, I think, some mistakes made in how to understand this 2,300 days. The Hebrew there does not say 2,300 days. It actually says 2,000, it actually says morning, or evening, morning, 2,300. What that means is we really have 1,150 days. Now that's getting very close to that time, times, and half a time that we've already talked about, the 1,260 days. And that, if we understand that there is a very near run of Eastern and Western Antichrist, the Eastern Antichrist has about 110 years prophetically less than the Western Antichrist in his run. That's what's involved here. It's not 2,300 days for years. That's what we're talking about. There have been people, I think, who've made mistakes with respect to that. That would put this number way beyond any kind of navigable ability to make it mesh with other numbers that have to do with the time of apostasy. And so the period, I think, should be 1,150 days. And if we remember, in this, you know, a lot of people object to this idea of a day for a year. We're going to come back to that. I mean, Daniel's going to make it clear that's what he's talking about in the next chapter. But the fact is this, the Jews understood this very principle, and they applied it when looking forward to the coming of Messiah. And they understood that a day represented a year in prophecy very often. Now, I know there are people who say, well, 2,300 days, that could also have a backward look at Antiochus Epiphanes and what he did. Because evening and morning could be referring to the two sacrifices. They would sacrifice twice a day in the temple. And the period of time when he defiled the temple runs for approximately 1,150 days. And there are others who have seen it as 2,300 days, or just a little over 6 years. That number as well does fit with certain things that Antiochus Epiphanes did. But again, the significance of Antiochus Epiphanes is not Antiochus Epiphanes, but the fact that he has lent himself to being a type of the Eastern Antichrist, just as Judas lent himself, by being the son of perdition, to a type of the Western Antichrist. So, the 1150 and the 1260, those periods of time, we're going to see, they're a little bit easier to bring together, reconcile, and make, in fact, intelligible. All right, we want to look finally at Daniel 8, 16 and 17.
Daniel 8, verses 16 and 17. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of Eli, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, fell upon my face. And he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision.
Yeah, I want you to think about it. For at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, Daniel is pointing then. The time of the end, he's talking about the beginning of the Messianic era. So he sees something, at least, in this vision that moves from the Greek kingdom into the Messianic era and has implications for what we now call the New Testament era. He's not content. And this is another reason why I don't think we can see this simply as being fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes. You know, he does present himself as a type. I don't dispute that. But again, there are things here, there are elements here that are clearly pointing beyond and into the Messianic era. And that just doesn't fit Antiochus Epiphanes. And Christ himself uses Antiochus Epiphanes as an antitype in the Olivet Discourse. Again, that does not fit the lifetime of Antiochus Epiphanes. So we know that he's used as a type of Antichrist. We know that there are ramifications that are going beyond this. And here Daniel, I believe, is telling us, look, this vision is for at the time of the end. And he's told that that's what he is to understand. In other words, don't try to fit this in all now. Daniel isn't even really going to see the transition from Medo-Persian to the Greek Empire. But he's allowed to see enough into the future to know that this is going to happen. So just as we saw that the Roman Empire is going to dissolve into 10, and out of that will come a little horn, in this chapter we're told that the Greek Empire, the third empire, will dissolve into 4, and out of one of those will come a little horn. Somewhere out of that kingdom. And that one is going to look toward the south and the east and toward the pleasant land. He's a king of fierce countenance, but he's talking peace. He's a king who understands dark sentences, who stands up. Some of this doesn't really fit Antiochus Epiphanes. It's much more conducive to this idea of Islam. And we need to remember that although some of these prophecies do find an antitypical fulfillment, and we'll see that in the fall of Jerusalem, it's an antitype of Judgment Day, but it is not the second coming. Even though there's going to be language used of that that fits the second coming. But people who can't discern between antitype and fulfillment are going to make the same mistake here in this. They're going to be drawn to make this terminate, this fulfillment terminate, in something that it can't possibly, because it doesn't really have the reach into the New Testament era. The next time, we'll pick up with Daniel 9, and we will see that, in fact, Daniel is looking for the Messianic era, and will correct some of the errors that have come into prophetical thinking through premillennialism, particularly through dispensational premillennialism.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwaters Revival Books.